All right, I think at this point we'd like to get started again with our last panel. This last panel will be led by Patty Cushing, and this will be discussing NFA's exam process. So I'll turn it over to Patty.
Thanks, Christy. You know, we're going to get started, but I do want to remind everyone of these evaluation forms at your table. We really do appreciate your feedback. So as, you know, we're starting here, if you could please start filling them out, we would appreciate that. So welcome to the NFA examination panel. How many of you have gone through an NFA examination and live to tell about it? So here we are. Fantastic. So we're going to go through this. I am Patty Cushing, a director in NFA's Chicago Compliance Department. I oversee our examination staff, and I'm also responsible for training them and writing the programs that they follow when they do their exams of your firms. Joining me today are three fantastic managers. We have Dorothy Zielinski, Nicole Walls, and Pete Kroll. Pete and Nicole handle exams, and Dorothy is in our risk management area. So to get us started, you know, there are 4,000 NFA members that we are responsible for monitoring for compliance with NFA rules and CFTC regulations. And we find that the most efficient way to monitor and a really comprehensive way to monitor those firms is to do an examination of them. But with 4,000 members, we're only getting to about 500-600 of them a year. So we have to analyze who we're going to go see first. And so Dorothy, who works in our risk management area, is going to share with us some of that process on how we narrow down who we're going to visit next.
All right. Thank you so much, Patty. Good morning, everyone. I am very pleased to be here with all of you. Thank you for turning up. I will speak a little bit to our risk management process, both from a 30,000 feet holistic to also how does it affect me. I'm sure all of you are wondering how is it that the risk management team picked your firm to be examined. Simply speaking, our mission is quite simply stated, not so simple to execute, but it is to continuously identify, assess, evaluate, and monitor our membership population. And it is also to prioritize the riskiest firms for examination, deploy our exam teams to those firms, and then get a feedback loop from them in terms of what types of risks we observed. So by way of background, you know, prior to 2005, NFA maintained a risk assessment priority program that evaluated members based on a list of factors. This was rather extensively enhanced in 2010 to incorporate data points and information, a lot of which I term right now operational insights about our member population. And this was a very expert-based model. So based on things we observed in the past, we came in and assessed whether or not we had other firms that exhibited those same characteristics and then identified risk factors for those particular member firms. In 2014, we continued to enhance our risk model development, and we shifted our member firm assessment more into a business problem solving as well as a predictive analytics focused solution. So with that said, our data science team comprises individuals with a combination of computer science, math, business skills. A lot of times when talking about predictive analytics, you will hear terms such as machine learning, data mining, data science, artificial intelligence. Those are all fancy terms for, you know, trying to identify characteristics of firms that today exhibit the same characteristics as firms we've had issues with in the past. Our analysis is right now split into the membership population. So we have models around our CPO population, our CTA population, our IB population, and then we have an index-based model for our FCMs. One of the ways that we explore our data across our systems, so I will actually start this before I even tell you anything about how we explore our data. I will ask by a show of hands how many of you just love filling out our annual questionnaire.
No way.
I know the feeling. We're actually working on revamping the questionnaire, particularly because as many of you who are engaged in either virtual currencies or swaps transactions know, there aren't really questions on the annual questionnaire that are tailored to your business operations. So we're focusing our efforts on ensuring that those questions are more tailored to your business, more clearly stated. I think a lot of times the feedback that we've received from our members has been that some of the questions, they're not quite sure if it relates to their CPO operations, if it relates to their CTA operations. So we are working on that. But that is one of the key factors. It's pretty important to me, so I say this whenever I can, to as much accuracy as you can. If you have any questions, we have a wonderful information center that would be more than willing to help you, to walk you through that questionnaire. But we use that data along with a plethora of other areas within our system, such as, you know, your financial filings, your PQRs, your quarterly PRs for CTAs, which I'll speak to some of the data points in there a little bit later, your IB financials, as well as some of the filings that might not be financial filings. So when you submit something for pre-review, you know, we use all of those data points throughout those systems as well as across our organization to be able to evaluate and have a holistic picture of your operations. With that said, we also gather data through our exam teams and our experts that go out into the field. So we do a lot of business gathering from them to understand, you know, what are operations looking like across our membership population, and how can we draw on some of the data points that we have available to us to paint that picture. From a modeling standpoint, we use various models to evaluate, you know, which best predict an action outcome. And that's what we're striving to do. So, like I said just a little bit earlier, we are trying to find patterns in the data of firms that either come through our door or that we are already monitoring that exhibit characteristics similar to those we found issues with in the past. So that pretty much sums up the risk management method quantitative. And then we also have a qualitative overlay, I call this, and it's basically we have our model, our models give us a score for each firm and they're ranked, and then we overlay that output with a lot of additional querying of data to be able to paint a picture. So, for example, if you have an AP that left and you update your questionnaire to disclose a loss of clients, we take a look at that, we factor that into whether or not that AP went elsewhere and the client count went up. Which is also why I highly, highly encourage you to update the annual questionnaire when material changes to your operations occur. It helps not only with you representing to us how your operations are going, but it also helps us understand your operations as well. Additionally, we do a lot of data visualization with our data. And then through prioritization, we speak with our directors, Patty, Sarah, and others, to basically highlight some of the firms that we are proposing for examination. Once that gets approved through our management managing director team, the firms are then proposed for the schedule. So I will then speak a little bit to our risk-based exam selection process. Certainly, we take the model outputs, as I've just mentioned, and in prioritizing our firms, we take a lot of staff observations as well. So I alluded to a little bit earlier this feedback loop that we get from our exam teams. We inquire, you know, into not only the programs, the exam programs that they fill out when they are at your firms to be able to understand your businesses and ensure your compliance, but we also then ask them to basically summarize for us some of the high-level observations from an operational, financial, personnel standpoint, internal controls, AML standpoint. We take those observations. We certainly also have other means by which we get insight about our membership. It includes anything from, you know, you calling in to customer complaints to, you know, tips should we receive any. We compile all of that information and we prioritize our firms, as I've mentioned a little bit earlier. We also have, obviously, regulatory required exams. So for those of you that are six-month IBs, and if you haven't filed a certified financial statement within 6 months of your membership, you've certainly had an examination by the NFA team, and that's a requirement of ours, similarly to some others. And additionally, I mentioned, you know, ad hoc reviews. And data conveyance is kind of a key point for my team, and that's to ensure that all of the work and all of the data that we've seen we convey to our exam team so that they are best equipped to be able to look at those risks across the member that they are visiting. That pretty much sums it up.
You know, as Dorothy said, it's a risk-based exam selection process. So I had a couple people stop me and say, NFA hasn't been to my office in a while, and you know, don't you come every 3 or 4 years? We don't have a set cycle of us coming. So it is very much using this risk-based analysis to help us decide who we visit next. And one of the factors we do look at is how long it's been since we've been there, and there kind of is an end point where we get a little nervous if we haven't been to someone, so we might be back, but it's a longer term period, so you don't have to worry about that.
Yep, and then one thing that I said I would mention and I almost forgot was in the quarterly filings for the CTAs, many of you that are CTAs have found that since June of last year, we have requested that you put in some financial ratios within that filing. We are taking a look. We're beginning to take a look at those financial ratios. Some of you may hear from my team in the near future. We will most likely be corresponding with you just to get some additional insight and clarity around those financial points. But we are looking at those and trying to evaluate how we will incorporate those in our models in the future.
So to talk about those ratios in a little bit more detail, this is the ratios that we put in with the June 2017 filings that is regarding the financial situation of the CPO and the CTA itself, not your pools and things of that nature. So it's your firm itself, and there's two ratios that we collect. One is basically a quick ratio, a comparison of your assets to your liabilities, and the other is an expense ratio, a comparison of your expenses to your revenues. So as Dorothy mentioned, we're starting to look at those. It's, you know, we've got 4 data points right now, and so we're really looking at trends. It's not something that's been built into the models yet. It's more being handled by Dorothy and her team to look at the trend and how you are doing. And so back to what Dorothy said about making sure that if you have a material change in your operations that you update your annual questionnaire. We say annual, but really any material change would impact it, because, you know, some people are like, oh, you know, this ratio doesn't look very good, but compared to my business operations, exactly. If we know what your operations really is based on your questionnaire data, then it explains to us that ratio. So we do see, you know, why you would have a certain ratio based on your operations. So please do keep that updated. But during the examination, we are also looking at these ratios. And Nicole, can you share with us what it is that we're seeing on exams?
Yes, sure. So like Patty mentioned, we are looking at these ratios while we are out on our exams. And in order to test them, we'll ask for support, which is one of the findings that we've had when we go out to firms, is that we aren't able to get adequate support for the ratios. So just a reminder to make sure that there is support behind those numbers, that we can do some testing on it. So that's one finding we've had. And then another issue that we've run into is that the ratios under the requirements should be prepared on an accrual basis. In a lot of instances, we're finding that they're being prepared on the cash basis.
Okay, perfect. Are there any questions so far on the risk management process or these ratios before we move on to the exam process? All right. It was a little early, but I thought I'd ask. Okay, so, you know, the risk management group has identified firms that need to be visited by the examiners, and they provide that list to the exam team. And so, Peach, you are leading up a team who has been provided with a list of firms that you need to go to. What do you do to get yourself prepared for that?
Yes, good morning, everybody. So once Dorothy's team gets my team, which typically includes a director, myself as a manager, a supervisor, and a couple staff, we'll start going through some of the information that Dorothy's team's provided us, but in more detail. Claude had mentioned the online registration system earlier. We'll look at the firm's APs and principals, see where they worked in the past. Has there been any disciplinary history with any of the firms? Have there been any trends in registration status? Have there been any changes? In addition to that, we will look into whether you guys, whether this member has been examined in the past, if we've had any findings, if there are any trends within the exams. Patty had mentioned before that, you know, for our exams as far as how many years, but we will look to see, you know, if somebody hasn't been audited in 8 to 10 years, obviously there's additional risk involved with all the new regulations that have been adapted since. Somebody, I think Dorothy Pryor had mentioned complaints. We get complaints from customers of the members. We also get complaints from other members. We get a lot of anonymous complaints, you know, that we got to figure out if they're, you know, legit. From there, we can, you guys, a lot of our members submit promotional materials. So we'll look at those and see, you know, what kind of materials our firm's providing. Obviously, we'll do an online search, and there's a lot of materials that are out there that have not been submitted to us. The annual questionnaire has been mentioned several times. That kind of gives us a little bit of a basic background of the firm, you know, customer base, solicitation process. Do you guys have a website? And then some of the last factors, you know, for the CPOs and CTAs, we'll look at the quarterly filings to see if there's any additional trends. We get to look at the each program of the CTAs, each of the funds, and, you know, net asset value, change in customer base. And lastly, for the IBs, there's a semi-annual financial requirement. So, you know, we're getting the net capital computations, we're getting balance sheets, we're seeing trends in, you know, commission revenues and whatnot. So from there, we deem which of the firms that are provided by Dorothy's team as a little bit more risky, per se. And we oftentimes will make a courtesy call to our firms to announce the exam. And for our smaller firms, sometimes we're able to have an initial conversation right there. For our larger firms, we like to get, obviously, more individuals involved. So we'll set up our basic initial examination pre-interview, which, again, we'll ask about the basic operations of the firm. Have there been any changes over the last couple years? Again, do you guys use promotional materials? Do you guys do your accounting and or your performance internally, or do you use third parties? And from there, we'll essentially establish the initial dates for our examination. After that call, we'll get our the team will get together and we'll kind of go over the initial scopes and what we deem to be areas of risk for our firms. Obviously, recently, ISSP has been a big area that we've been looking into, which was obviously discussed on an earlier panel. But we will meet with the director and we will put out our initial document request list, which will give you some background of how you can upload the information to what I believe is an external server, the regulatory filing system, where you could securely upload the documents to us. One of the things that makes the examination process go very smoothly is for us first to announce the exam early enough where we can get our member involved to answer our questions prior to getting in the field and prior to uploading the information. But obviously, that initial document request list is very preliminary, and we'll have a lot more follow-up. So that gets us to the fieldwork process.
Before we move on to that, you know, during that initial call when you announced it, you talked about, you know, telling them what dates you're going to be there. And a lot of you do use third-party service providers who maybe do your performance or are admins. And it's a good idea that when we announce it to give those providers a heads up that NFA is coming and what dates and who is it at their firm that can help you during that process, who's going to be available if there's questions that you can't answer. So just something to not just, you know, panic, but line up who's going to be helping you during this process. Okay, so after pre-exam, you enter the field and with your supervisor and staff, and what's the process then?
So, yeah, now we're in the field, and similar to the call that we had prior, now we're going to do another call with the firm that gets into a little bit more detail about what records you provided us. maybe some follow-up questions that we have based on our preliminary interview, and essentially setting up the expectations of the examination. We try to give you dates that we think that we will be there. You know, for instance, we'll be there just for the week. Oftentimes it can go a little bit longer. Sometimes it can go a little bit shorter. Never does it end after that week. There will be a lot of follow-up afterwards. Oftentimes, we essentially have 4 months to get the exams closed or get the exam report issued. And as indicated before, Dorothy's team will give us a handful of firms, sometimes up to 6 or 7 to do in a 2 or 3 month period. So oftentimes we'll go in the field for a week or two at your firm, and then we'll move on to the next member, and then we'll get back to you. So again, the biggest thing is for us to do a good job providing the expectation and getting you involved in the exam process early, prior to us being in field work or in the field, but also for our members to, make themselves available to answer questions and provide us all the documents timely, because it helps the process greatly. So again, after we set up the expectations, we'll have the big interview with most of the senior firm personnel, but then we'll also try to set up separate interviews for, if there's a cybersecurity team, if there's a team that's involved in opening or account opening documents, with the accountants to look at, talk about the balance sheet and talk about, what income does the firm have and all that stuff. Last two things that we'll do during field work before we actually get to our testing is we'll review all the records that you have provided us up to this point, and we'll make our additional requests. Like I said, a lot of our initial requests are preliminary, and we'll have to get into more detail as far as, which accounts we want to look at, which pool we want to look at, which CTA program we want to look at if you have multiple programs or multiple funds. And then one of the last things that we do just consistently through our exams is monitor, the firm operations. Who's doing what, who's reporting to who sits where. Typically, if it's hard to define size, but medium or larger operations for us, we'll kind of want a tour of the office to see, who sits where, who does what. Is there a call center? Are people talking to the clients? Are these individuals listed or registered as APs? Do they need to be? So throughout the entire process, we're going to be monitoring the operations, all while, initially selecting our scope. So
Pete, I'm going to, you've talked a lot about, the initial document requests and when we announce the firms, but I'm going to ask Nicole, there are certain circumstances when we do not announce an exam, and how does the process differ as a result?
Sure. So obviously a lot of what Pete has mentioned as far as having the initial call, giving you the heads up that we're going to be out there, and sending the document request list won't happen prior to us arriving. So we'll be at your office and, have hopefully within the first couple hours of being there have a discussion so that we can learn some of the things that we otherwise would have learned ahead of time as far as where the risks are, really get to understand your operations, and then most likely the document request list will come towards the end of that first day, if not first thing the second day. So we understand it's, quite a different process, and we try to be understanding of your operations and don't want to be too much of an interruption, but we do expect to be able to have those first initial conversations with firm personnel when we get there in the field.
Thanks. And so, we've gotten this far, and we're at the process of actually doing our testing and reviewing things. So what are some of the common areas of focus on the exam?
Yeah, so I think overall we have 20 to 25 modules that we could do, depending on the registration category. But as discussed on one of the panels earlier, AML is an area at our IBs and potentially at CPOs and CTAs and that way down the road that we will look into. And the typical deficiencies and the typical areas that we do test pretty much on every IB exam is the AML training for individuals that are working in area susceptible to money laundering, and the annual independent AML examination. I know you guys have heard 365 a lot today, so I'll just say one more time, 365 days is what we are looking for to be within the requirement. But the other thing, you know, AML over the last, 5 years, there's been some new updates, and a lot of our members have had their AML programs tested in the past by us. So sometimes we'll test the entire program again. Sometimes we will just focus on the new regulations and make sure that they are implemented into your program. As far as CPOs go, our main area of testing is pool financial or pool reporting. So you guys are sending monthly or quarterly statements to the participants in your fund. We are going to pick a month, maybe 2 months, pick a customer, sometimes two customers or two participants, and, kind of detail test that account statement, making sure that it includes everything from all the regulations.
And so we're going to look to verify the existence of the assets in that pool, right? And so earlier today, Sarah's talking about the pools that are actually investing in the actual underlying cryptocurrency, and that's a big part of this notice that Sarah's talking about is the fact that right now there is no set standardized way that the AICPA has put out that says this is how you verify the existence of cryptocurrencies. And so, that's a big issue with respect to that particular asset class. So it comes up in this pool reporting area when we're looking at your balance sheet and your financial testing as to whether or not the assets that you've reported to your customers as being in the pool truly do exist.
Yeah, so typically look for us to request confirmations early in the process for our funds. For CTAs, our biggest area of concern is the performance that is being reported in the disclosure documents or in promotional materials that are being provided to current or potential customers. So we will do a detailed review of, the internal records of each of the, well, not of each of the programs, but potentially pick one program, go into more detail. Promotional material throughout all three of the registration categories. We are going to look for websites. We are going to look for tear sheets. We're going to look for PowerPoints, emails, any communications that would be considered promotional material. We'll do a detailed review, make sure that there's proper disclosures, and essentially make sure that the documents are not being used in a misleading manner.
So, Nicole, when you guys are doing all this testing and you find deficiencies, how is that handled?
So when we're out in the field and even post-field work, when we're still doing our follow-up testing, one of the things that we like to do is make sure that we alert you of anything that we found as soon as we find it, so that you can work towards corrective action and getting that to us even before responding to the formal report. So that is something that the supervisors lay out, and Pete mentioned, like, setting expectations. That is something that will make you aware of and let you know that we will be coming to you with anything that we find along the process so that we can work with you to figure out how to make sure we address it.
Okay, and if we put it in a report that it is a deficiency, then the firm would have to respond to that report?
Right. So once we send the formal report, so we'll do a formal exit interview before issuing the exam report. Most of that will be a recap of information that you've already heard from us throughout the process, but then we will issue the formal report, and you'll have 10 business days to respond in writing to the report indicating what you've done to correct the deficiency. Even a step further than that, we ask that you give us information about what led to this, if there were any control issues that led to the deficiency, just to kind of take a overall look at it and not just have you focus on one specific finding, but just to kind of think, did this impact any other areas of the business?
Great. So what are some of the common deficiencies that we see, and how can people avoid them?
So one area that we look at a lot on exams is making sure that all the proper individuals are listed as principals and then registered as APs. Regarding principals, part of the rule is that certain individuals with titles like CFO or COO are required to be listed simply based on their title. So we are seeing instances where people with those titles are not properly listed in our system. We also see instances where individual indirect owners that indirectly own more than 10% of the company are not listed. And then one part of the rule that's often overlooked are when someone contributes more than 10% of the capital of a company. So it could be not through a formal stock certificate or change in the operating agreement, but for whatever reason they've contributed capital to your company that's more than 10%, those individuals would have to be listed as well. Regarding APs, one instance or example that we've seen this come up is where firms will have salespeople that they'll have call potential customers, and those individuals are not registered. And the reason that we'll get from firms is that they're not really doing much. Once a customer, potential customer, indicates they're interested, they'll be transferred to a registered AP. It's oftentimes that when we hear what these unregistered individuals are saying to us, it sounds like a solicitation. So it's a gray line, it becomes blurry, and for us, I think the way that what we look for from the firms is to make sure that there is a clear audit trail of what these individuals are saying so that we can gain comfort that they don't need to be registered. Regarding promotional material, Pete mentioned that's another area that we look at while on exams. Obviously, with all the different forms of social media out there, we're seeing firms using all the different mediums and even individual APs going out there and soliciting under their individual names to try to get customers for the firm. And we are seeing where the firms do not have adequate procedures to supervise. So, I mean, there's a lot of different ways, and a lot of times people are posting very frequently, so making sure that your procedures are in line with your operations and how you're using these mediums so that you can show us that you're adequately supervising and maintaining a trail to support that you've done that.
You know, Nicole, something I've see occasionally in promotion material is statements of opinion that can't be supported, and it's sort of your superlative statements. Avoid superlative. You can't prove that you're the best or the fastest on anything, so those types of opinions, which are clearly opinions, but they have to have a reasonable basis in fact, and it's very difficult to support something when you say that. So, yeah.
Another thing that we're seeing is firms using banner ads or just placing information about their firm on a third-party website, and firms don't really have, again, adequate procedures to supervise where they're placing this information. One thing we look at is, you know, your banner itself might be adequate and not have anything that's misleading, but the website that you're putting it on might have information around it that could mislead a potential investor. So just keeping an eye out, having some sort of procedure that says you'll go to those third-party websites and review what's around your banner to make sure that it wouldn't be misleading to a potential investor. And then one thing to mention, we do have the service available that you can submit your promotional material to NFA for pre-review and receive comments back on it. This is a great service for a free service for our members to submit their material if you have any questions about, you know, what we would consider misleading or if we are not comfortable with your opinions that you're including in the material. It's a great way to get our feedback on that prior to using it. Disclosure documents for CPOs and CTAs is an area that we obviously are looking at when we're at those types of members. And one thing that we'll often find is that what's disclosed in the disclosure document does not align with the actual operations. So an example, the fees disclosed in the disclosure document are 2% and 20%, but you're really charging 2.5% and 25%. So things like that where when we are reviewing the disclosure documents in the office, we don't have a lot of information about your operations, but then once we come out into the field and start doing our testing, we obviously can see what fees are actually being charged and notice that it doesn't line up. So just making sure that what's disclosed in the document aligns with your actual operations.
And Nicole, you know, many people in the room are 4.7 exempt, and so they don't actually have disclosure documents that they pre-file with NFA for acceptance, but you have offering memorandums or some other written document that explains to your customers what you're about. Sometimes it's just your due diligence questionnaires that you have filled out for clients. All of that is considered disclosure, and we're going to check to be sure your operations is consistent with that. So you mentioned fees. Trading strategy is another thing where you've given us this big description about how you're going to trade, and you said you were only going to do ags, and you're in financial futures. So, you know, all of that style drift, et cetera, is things we're going to look at.
Again, related to CPOs and CTAs and these disclosure documents or even tear sheets, we're noticing issues where the rates of return are not being calculated correctly. Another thing to mention that's on our website is a disclosure document guide that includes not only information about what's required to be in there if you are not 4-7 exempt, but also gives information about how to do the rates of return calculations. So we encourage you to go to our website and pull that resource and use it while you're preparing that document or while you're reviewing it to make sure it's accurate. One final thing on CPOs and CTAs and disclosure documents. We'll see issues where firms don't have support that the customer received the disclosure document or the disclosure document prior to signing the advisory agreement or subscription documents. So that's one thing that we will select a sample of customers to make sure that they receive that prior to funding and opening their account. And we run into instances where we aren't able to get that support. Pete already mentioned, as far as at CPOs, our main focus is going to be looking at the account statements that are provided to pool participants. And the main finding that we have in that area is that fund level information is not being included on these statements. So we'll see where the individual participant's interest in the fund and the performance over the month or quarter is adequately disclosed. But under Part 4, you're also required to give the fund level information. So just keeping that in mind as you're preparing those and reviewing Part 4 and everything that's required to be included under that. The account statements also have to have an oath or affirmation. That's another common finding, that it's a simple signature and some language at the bottom of it indicating that you attest that the information is accurate. But we continually find that that's not being included on the statements. Overdue items, we've touched on this again a number of times in relation to AML, but just to remind again about all of the annual requirements as far as training and audit, some not as frequent as annual, but just making sure that you have a good schedule and reminders to ensure that all of this is being done as required by the rules or as required by your own procedures when it comes to things like ethics. Our website, we do include information for each registration category about some of the annual requirements. That includes filling out your annual questionnaire, doing your self-exam checklist. A lot of these things will help remind you about the training requirements that we will be looking for while we're at the exam. One final area we wanted to touch on, record keeping, is specifically in relation to swap IBs. And we've mentioned that this is a new area for us that we've been going out to a lot of our firms and doing testing to recreate the transactions that are being brokered at the firms. And so a lot of that is requesting records to be able to see the audit trail, to hear the phone calls or read the chats that were associated with specific transactions. And we'll run into instances where firms aren't able to provide us with the transactional data. So their phone recording system was down or, you know, for whatever reason, the records that you are required to be kept, you're not able to provide for us.
That's a good list. Pete, did we miss anything? What else are you seeing?
The one thing that I see, I'd say on half of my exams, especially at CTAs, is the bunched order quarterly reviews. If you're not familiar with it, we're obviously looking to make sure that no clients within a program are getting preferential treatment. It's NFA compliance rule 210, and for more detail, please look at interpretive notice 9029.
And basically it says that, you know, we know when you allocate split fills to your bunched orders, you're checking it every trade. This is taking a step back, and the interpretive notice says, you know, if different accounts are achieving different performance, that it should not be due to your allocation method. So that's why you have to do it. So making sure you have that quarterly review and evidence of that review is required. Good. Okay, so I wanted to just briefly touch on, you know, we have a fair percentage of our members who are not located in the U.S., and you might have affiliated entities that this applies to. So we did want to talk about the fact that we do also examine international firms and how we go about doing that. So for decades, we called them box audits because we were in Chicago or New York, and the firm, let's say in Italy, boxed up their audits, their records, and sent them to us, and we sat in a conference room, which is also a box, and reviewed it all. But clearly, in today's day and age, with electronic records, we now call them virtual exams, and it's the same thing. We're still sitting in a conference room, and the firm will send us their, upload their documents to the same web-based system that our U.S. firms use, and we will review them and do a lot of, you know, correspondence through email and phone calls to get the examination completed. We also have started, we always cooperate with the regulators in that jurisdiction. We make sure that they know that we have joint members. If they've done an examination, we get information with respect to what their review of that firm was so that we can adjust our scope appropriately. But we also do some on-site exams. So a couple years ago, we started to go to London to do them. As you can imagine, every time a U.S. Regulator wants to go into a foreign jurisdiction, it is not as easy as you would think. You know, there's visa issues, there's certainly privacy laws, and that's in those other jurisdictions, so we do have to be careful of that, and we work through those issues with our outside counsel. So we have started to go to London, and we've been doing that for a couple years. This past year, we went to Singapore, and we will be going to Hong Kong later this summer. So we are getting to, again, when the risk management group says there's risks at a firm, we want to be sure that we are able to examine them. And so that's what we've been doing. So we continue to do that. We do some still as virtual exams, and some we do go on site for. That's where we stand with international exams. So are there questions regarding the exam process, things we've mentioned? Okay, just a second.
Thank you. For the swap dealer exams, excuse me, are they going to, is it a similar process to what you've outlined today, or is it somewhat?
Examinations are very similar to what we do. They have clearly different areas of focus that they review, but it is a similar process where, as what we described.
Under the harmonization rules with investment advisors that are also CPOs that manage mutual funds that are 4.5 exempt, how is the examination process differ? Because it seems like the examination process you're talking about is really a straight commodity pool, but as a member who manages pools that are mutual funds, this, can you explain how the difference between the two examination approaches?
I can. You know, so the areas of focus that Pete went into are very similar, actually. It's just that your rules are harmonized in the fact that the CFTC has indicated that if, you know, whatever statements you provide to your participants are, you know, under SEC rules are acceptable to the CFTC, whatever disclosure you provide pursuant to SEC regulations are acceptable to the CFTC. So, you know, we're still going to look at that disclosure. We're not going to look at it to be sure it has ABC through triple X that the CFTC requirements say, but we're still going to look at your operating consistent to your disclosure. Clearly, you don't provide this full Part 4 compliant account statement, but you do provide NAV per share or, you know, per share every day. You post that on for your mutual funds on your website. So we're going to look to that and then make sure that that number is accurate. We're going back to your balance sheet. You know, we got to make sure that the net assets are accurate. We're going to check with your transfer agent regarding the shares value to be sure the NAV per share is accurate. So it's very similar with the understanding that the very specific information isn't CFTC regulations, but it still has to be accurate.
One more question. I heard a vicious rumor that during the exam there's a 72-hour turnaround for requests. Is that true? And how, if it is true, how strictly is that enforced?
I'm going to let Nicole take that
sure.
one.
I don't. There's no strict time frame that you have to provide the documents with. Usually when we send the initial doc request list, depending on timing, we'll give you an initial time frame of when we'd like a certain subset of documents. So the critical documents that will help us get the testing going, we'll give a shorter time frame on, and then we'll include another date in there for the rest of the documents. As the course of the exam goes on, the best thing for us is to get the documents timely for us to be able to get through everything quickly. If we notice that, you know, we're running into issues where our testing is being held up because we aren't getting documents from a firm, we might start to put stricter deadlines on the request, but there is no firm deadline for when we expect to have requests.
And so if you're not going to be able to make these deadlines that we are really, you know, enforcing based on our workflow, you know, you just have to talk to your lead examiner about the issue and provide them, don't just say this is impossible, provide them with a what you think is a more realistic time frame and what the struggle is, and understand that they, you know, we have to get this finished. So, you know, we hope that we can... Negotiate's kind of a strong word, right? But we hope we can work that out. Well, Caitlin, we need a microphone all the way in the front. Sorry. Oh, Christy Skoser.
So this is pertaining to principals and APs and the listing of them. I'm with a very large investment management firm. We have a very small commodity pool operation through our registered mutual funds and then also through some private placement funds. How far up the chain do you go, the chain of command with the principal? Because we get stuck, do you stop at the pool, you know, the board of the pool, or do you go up into the investment, the managers, you know, CIO, CEO? How high?
So the principal definition is a little different than the AP. It's very different than the AP definition, right? So for principal, you're looking strictly at do they hold the title that's listed in the rule. It's very definition-based. If they are chief financial officer, they must be a principal. You know, so you have to look at the specific titles. And when it says director, it means board of directors of the CPO, not your pool. So the reporting line is actually for APs, all right? So APs are, Ron mentioned this earlier, an AP is somebody who solicits funds for your pool or solicits customers. They're in the solicitation process, or it's anybody who supervises those people. And that's where this chain of command comes in, and the CFTC has put out guidance that says, you know, it could be all the way up to your CEO, but you do need to look realistically at your structure, you know, and decide the buck stops here with respect to that. You know, if this person over here, who is not the CEO but does have the final authority to supervise, hire, and fire everybody below them, then you can say that it stops here in a very large structured entity. We like common sense. Common sense is, you know, but have reasons why you decided it was this person and be sure that person understands that. And, you know, because an examiner might interview that person and say, oh, well, who do you report to? And they have to know, well, the buck stops with me on these people. Other questions? Oh, here we go. Oh, great. Oops, it's not on.
Thanks. How do you determine which firms receive announced versus unannounced exams?
You know, You can handle that. Thank you.
Sure. I think a lot of it is based on our schedules and timing. You know, if our schedule allows and it makes sense to announce the exam, we obviously would prefer to announce it. But sometimes just based on our schedules, different risks that we perceive at a firm, it just might not make sense to announce it.
So there's no real formula. I mean, clearly if somebody has called to alleged, you know, like at a pool operator, I called the firm and requested my withdrawal and they keep putting me off, that's an indication that the funds don't exist. We're not going to notify you that we're coming, you know. So there's a lot of things like that, but Nicole's right. There's a lot of reasons that aren't as clear indication of fraud that still would mean we don't call.
When does the 120-day reporting guideline start? Does it start on the day of the first exam, the initial request?
The first day of the examination. So for a box exam, it would be, you know, we'd establish that date, but otherwise it would be the first day that we're in the field.
One of the things we usually talk about that we didn't today is the self-examination questionnaire. You know, that is something that is available on our website and required by our board of directors for every member to do once a year, 365 days, to go through this questionnaire and review your own operations for compliance with the various regulations. So everything, you know, that we've talked about is areas of focus and where the common deficiencies are, like, for example, who needs to be listed as a principal. There's all these very specific questions in the questionnaire. Does the people with the title of director, are they listed? You know, chief financial officer, are they listed as a principal? It's very specific and is really your roadmap for compliance. So if you do a thorough job of that review and understand what those questions are asking you, you know, you're 99% of the way there when we come to do an examination of you to be in compliance with our rules. It was designed for you to identify where you might have deficiencies and correct them before we get there. So we really want to stress that you take that process seriously, that you read it thoroughly. If there's something in there you don't understand, you information, be sure you call us and we will be happy to help you through anything there. We would rather you be in compliance. That is our 100% objective here. Any other questions for the examination panel? Okay. So at this point, I'm going to welcome Ron back up and the other panelists. Does anybody have any questions overall for anyone today? Woo, careful now.
Free advice.
Okay, well, again, I'd like...
They know all the answers.
They do. This is the most compliant crowd we're ever going to see. So, again, I do ask you to please provide us some feedback on today's session and other sessions you might want to get from NFA.
Okay, so before we close, I just really want to emphasize the importance of member input and engagement. And today's workshop is just one example of how we want to have an informed membership. We also want input from you guys as well, so receiving your thoughts and concerns is just as valuable an educational form for us as well as keeping you informed. And we try to do these things through not only these workshops, but we also have surveys and webinars and things like that. We would love your ideas of what other topics we should consider for future programs like this, but we also don't want you to wait until the next workshop to learn You have 8 names of NFA members, senior staff for you to reach out to if you have any questions, need some input, need some advice. I think that's the best way to have a regulatory agency program like NFA is working with our memberships to keeping them informed and making sure they're in compliance. And you also have, I think we have a tremendous, what we call information center at NFA. Call them all the time you want, anytime you want. You don't have to disclose your names. You can just say, I'm looking for information on either this form or a question that I might have. Take advantage of it. When I was in practice, I called NFA a lot to keep not only myself informed, but I have encouraged my clients to do the same. So we hope you enjoy these programs and hope to see you at a new program in the not-too-distant future. Patty, anything else?
Just thank you, Ron, Michael Bryce, Ben, and just everybody on the panels. And thank you all for coming and participating today.